This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In this week's Radio EcoShock show, we cover global climate news from the Syrian refugees to signs of an abrupt climate shift and everything in between with scientist Paul Beckwith. Plus, I've got a few tidbits of news they just won't tell you, and my new song aimed to promote activism for the Paris climate talks in late November this year. I'm Alex Smith. Let's go. Over the summer in the Northern Hemisphere, climate change put in an extreme appearance all over the world. It looks like 2015 will be the hottest year ever, another record-setting year in a string of hot years. Sooner or later, you think our civilization might begin to crack under the strain. Our next guest suggests a climate shift could be sooner than most people expect. It's time for our climate roundup with climate scientist and regular Radio EcoShock guest, Paul Beckwith from the University of Ottawa. Paul, welcome back.
Hi, Alex. It's always nice to come and to have a chat with you.
Yeah, we'll have a good talk, and I want to start out with one of the biggest stories of our times. Just let me read one paragraph from a paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences from March 2, 2015, and they say, there is evidence that the 2007-2010 drought contributed to the conflict in Syria. It was the worst drought in the instrumental record, causing widespread crop failure and a mass migration of farming families to urban centers. And then they conclude that the severe drought was 2 to 3 times more likely due to human-induced climate change. And so, really, Paul, are the millions on the move out of the Middle East also climate refugees?
I think that the short answer to that is yes. I think climate change is the root cause. And of course, as the U.S. military often says, you know, climate change is a threat multiplier. So it can get things moving. It can trigger, say, the drought can trigger, you know, these crop failures, massive crop failures, and then in turn, the farmers have to do something. They tend to move to the cities or they want to migrate to other countries, and there's lots of unemployed people that are, you know, desperate, and desperate for food, desperate for income, and, you know, they're very susceptible to taking up arms and fighting, you know, and so on, having fights over scarcity of food, scarcity of water, things like that. So you really need to look at it as a big picture thing. I mean, for people that say, you know, the Syrian, the refugee crisis that's hitting Europe, and I think we're talking about numbers of 3,000 or 4,000 people per day going into the EU. You can't say it's the war is causing it, for example. I mean, yes, directly, but that's a very simplistic view. Why is there the war? You know, how long has it been going on? What happened before? What was going on? And clearly the drought just massacred food production in many parts of that region.
Yeah, well, it kind of makes sense when you think about it. I mean, the Iranians just had a day where the heat and humidity combined felt like 165 degrees Fahrenheit or 74 degrees Celsius. There were deadly heat waves, as you know, Paul, across the Middle East, extending into Pakistan and India. Is it any wonder a lot of people are deciding to get out to go somewhere cooler, like Europe?
Yeah, I mean, you read my mind. I was just going to add that, you know, at the end of my last statement, but I thought I've talked long enough. I can let you have a question. But, yeah, I mean, the problem is that the regions that are near ocean bodies, normally they have a more moderate climate, right, because the ocean takes longer to heat up and longer to cool down. But the sea surface temperatures in some of those regions are 33 degrees Celsius. So they're keeping the temperature, you know, really, really warm. And if the winds are blowing, there's lots of evaporation. If the winds are blowing onshore, then it's carrying very moisture-laden air to coastal areas with that type of temperature. And you're reaching wet bulb temperatures of 35 degrees Celsius, which is kind of like an upper limit to human tolerance. So when there's 100% humidity at 35 degrees Celsius, the body, the core temperature rises of the body because you can't remove heat by sweating. You know, if that happens for a short period of time, day or two, then, then there's huge problems, huge fatalities, starting with the very young who are not able to sweat. and you know, but even very even people in prime of health, over a period of time, when the temperature is 35 degrees Celsius with 100% humidity, then the core temperature will rise, and the body systems will start shutting down. So we saw this happening in several places, and I never saw a report of the mortality numbers from those particular events, but I'm sure they were very high. I mean, we saw a similar thing in Japan, but not quite as high temperatures, right? That when the sea surface temperature around Japan was very, very warm, I don't know, a month or so ago, there were lots of fatalities in Japan arising from that because of the onshore winds were carrying that stifling air over major population centers there.
Well, a little later, we're going to talk about the blob that's been hanging off the West Coast. I don't want to quite go there yet because I want to return to Syria and something I've been thinking about. I mean, people get very hurt and upset when the Islamic State puts dynamite around the ancient temples in Syria and they blow up our common heritage. It's upsetting me. But really, Paul, we're doing the same thing with the ancient temple of nature. We put explosive barrels of oil and gas and tons of coal around the pillars that hold up the climate as we know it, and then we blow it up. I think our civilization, us, we're the real climate terrorists. How do you feel about that?
The really sad thing is completely unnecessary, right? I mean, it's completely unnecessary. If we had leadership, and we had leadership that was based on science, you know, we've known a lot about climate change for a long time. We're getting more and more information about it, and yet it seems to be, you know, extremely difficult for society to change direction until things get so bad that that happens perforce because the general public is sort of up in arms about it. And, you know, this is like the tipping point in human behavior that I see and that I see, you know, us approaching quickly. But yeah, I mean, you know, it'll be interesting in the future to see whether well-known climate deniers and CEOs of oil companies that have, there's solid evidence that they've sent out fraudulent information and denial on the problem for years and years, you know, I would expect that there would be a backlash against these people by the public, you know. And you know, we need a carbon price. We need a carbon tax, and it's so easy to implement. And yet, you know, we tend, because of business interests and stock people, stock market people, they want to, you know, create this cap and trade market to do it. You know, very complicated market that system that can be gamed, but brings, you know, lots of profit to the brokers involved. So, you know, but it's not necessary, right, for humanity to be this stupid right now.
Well, let's get to the science on the Greenland ice melt. There's been a lot coming out about that the IPCC predictions of 1 to 3 meters for 2100. It's just out the window now because of new figures on Greenland ice melt. What have you been seeing on that?
There's a doubling period for the melt rate from Greenland and from Antarctica. And that melt rate, you know, in Hansen's recent paper on superstorms and sea level rise, he talks about a time period of about 10 years, doubling period. But I think the number is closer, it seems to be closer to even 5 to 7 years. From what I can tell, and if you take a 7-year doubling period, you know, and project it out into the future, we're talking about a sea level rise of perhaps 7 meters by 2070, something like that. So that's a number that I've thrown out there, you know, just asking, can this happen? And if the doubling, you know, holds, then it will happen. I mean, it's not a question, you know, if we get, this is the nature of exponential growth. So, you know, is the ice sheet in Antarctica and Greenland capable of doing that? Now, Hansen makes the point that in Antarctica, there's a lot of regressive bedrock. So as you go inland, it gets deeper. And as you get the ice melting back, then it becomes unstable and can cause, you know, large nonlinear rise in sea level in Antarctica, you know, more so than in Greenland. But in Greenland, the problem is that the Arctic temperature amplification is so large, and the sea ice, you know, which we can talk about, is, you know, extreme. I mean, we should be calling it the Arctic Sea slush as opposed to Arctic Sea ice, I think. It's more like slush than ice. And we have at least another couple weeks, it looks like, of the before we reach the sea ice minimum. But Greenland's right up there. So when the sea ice goes and we get this large uptick in the Arctic temperature amplification warming, then Greenland will melt a lot faster. And Jason Box just showed this very interesting video that he obtained of somebody in an aircraft flying over a part of Greenland when there was a massive calving event, and it's beautiful video. I mean, you can see it's hard to get an idea of the scale, but the ice shelves are maybe poking out of the water about 100 meters or so, and they break off, and then you can see they turn upside down, quite a few of them, and you can see the blue, just a very deep blue ice with no air bubbles, which was the basal ice of the ice sheet. Yeah, and so the Hansen paper, you know, it talks about numbers like 2 to 3 meters of sea level rise in the space of about 30 years. This happened during the Eemian, a previous warm period, and the Eemian temperatures being similar to that of today had a rise, was basically, well, 5 to 9 meters higher. It was 9 meters higher towards the end of the Eemian, and it's very similar conditions to today in terms of the temperatures and so on.
And, you know, people picture, Paul, well, okay, the sea goes up 2 or 3 feet, we'll lose a little coastal real estate, but when you realize that, first of all, it doesn't just come neatly even all around the world, that some places it piles up deeper than others, especially along the U.S. East Coast, and then you think about the storm surges, I shudder to think what will happen to coastal cities like New York and all along New Jersey, but also Shanghai and around the world.
Yeah, I mean, I just spent some vacation. I had 10 days on the Outer Banks of North Carolina, and like really gorgeous area. You know, these are basically sandbars off the coast. I mean, they'll just be completely underwater. Yeah, I mean, the geography of the planet is going to be rewritten in the space of decades if this 3 meters, you know, in 30 years holds up. And the other thing is when you compare the, you know, when we talk about, you know, global temperature rise as compared to the past, right? I saw an interesting chart by David Spratt just earlier today, and if you take the average global temperature from 1980 to 2009, then it's gone up 0.85 degrees compared to pre-industrial, so 1750. But if you take the average over the last 10 years, so basically 2005 to 2014, then the rise compared to that 1750 baseline is 1.07 degrees Celsius. If you take just 2014, 1 year, that number is 1.17 degrees Celsius. And if you take this year, January through July for 2015, we're 1.26 degrees Celsius above that 1750 number. So, you know, it's misleading when you look at a 30-year average or even a 10-year average. I mean, we're seeing yearly, you know, of course, this year is a very massive El Nino, you know, and it's very, very, very warm. I mean, the entire Pacific Ocean is 1.02 degrees Celsius warmer than normal. That's the anomaly. And parts of the El Nino off South America, I saw a number 5.7 degrees. If you just go on Earth Null School, you know, and select sea surface oceans and sea surface temperature anomaly, and then zoom in on some of the hottest areas, that's the sort of number that you get, you know, extremely warm water. And the El Nino is still increasing in strength.
So how would we know whether the record heat so far this year is from just El Nino, or is it a real sign of global warming? How could we tell the difference?
First of all, the El Nino is behaving quite differently from a typical El Nino. I mean, I don't know if you remember, but for most of 2014, it was expected there would be a powerful El Nino, you know, like with 90% probability developing, and it took a lot longer. Of course, it didn't develop until beginning of this year. But when it, if you look at the temperature distribution of the water in the whole northern Pacific from the equator upwards, then as the El Nino is strengthening, then this warm Pacific blob is also strengthening. And then there's another warm Pacific blob sort of that splits between the equator and the latitudes, the high latitudes off Alaska. So there's these warm chunks of water. And of course, these are causing, right now as we speak, on Earth's Null School, if you have a look, it's you can clearly see at least five cyclones churning away in the Pacific Ocean. Now, three of them, they're Category 3 or higher storms. And this is, I don't think we've seen this, having three cyclones, they're not called hurricanes when they're in the Pacific, typhoons, having three storms, Category 3 or greater, simultaneously churning across just sort of northward of, I mean, they're missing Hawaii, fortunately, but it's projected that at least one or two of them may end up heading right up into the Arctic over the sea ice.
And you have a new two-part video out called The North Pacific Blowtorch. Is that what you're talking about? What will viewers expect there?
Yes. I was talking about in that video mostly how unusual the warmth is in the North Pacific, how this warm, so-called warm blob that has been persistent, how it relates to the ridges of the jet stream, this ridiculously resilient ridge, how it relates to the long and intense drought in California, and how the very warm seawater is flowing through the Bering Strait, and it's undercutting the ice, it's melting the ice from below, and you can actually see some very clear collapses of ice over, you know, in less than a week, like huge thinning of ice, you know, mostly in the Bering, in the Bering Strait side of the Arctic. Well, also, I mean, we've got very warm water on the other side in the North Atlantic, and this is also undercutting the ice from below, and then we have very warm land surfaces in, you know, across Asia, you know, Siberia, that sort of thing. So the rivers are feeding very warm, fresh water into the Arctic basin as well. And then we get these cyclones up there, which churn up the ice and also cause upwelling of water. So the ice is definitely under siege. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, typically the end of the melt season, so the minimum of Arctic sea ice, it varies, the date varies from about September 9th to September 21st, something like that, typically. Last year was the 15th. I mean, last year I thought it would extend past the 15th, but once it started switching, it switched very quickly. So, but it, I think it's only a matter of time before that date starts pushing up. And also we're getting things like a few days ago, there was one of these century declines in sea ice extent in the Arctic. And these are very, very, I think we lost about, I don't know, 140,000 square kilometers. So we had a century event, and these are very unusual in late August and September.
But Paul, we're talking about warmer oceans, and yet when I look at a map of the world with the recent warming, there is one cold blob, colder than normal, just south of Greenland in the North Atlantic. What's that about? And also, would that affect the coming weather for the UK and Europe?
Yes. So there was a paper, if you'll recall, earlier this year that talked about, that found that the Gulf Stream, first of all, the Gulf Stream has shifted. So the Gulf Stream used to extend up where that cold water pool is, but it no longer extends that far up. It goes further south. So the net result is the temperature anomaly is much colder than normal, where we're seeing it just south of Greenland, and it's warmer than normal just south of that region where the Gulf Stream is now predominantly carrying the heat. And this paper was talking about how the Gulf Stream shifting, especially around 2009, 2010, caused a sea level rise off of the east coast of North America by, you know, what was it, 5 inches or something over the space of that time period. So a massive, 125 millimeters or something over the space of, you know, over that time period, 2009-2010. And this was attributed to the Gulf Stream switching location. So that's one of the things. But the other thing that Hansen talks about is the increased calving and melt from Greenland is producing a lot of fresh and very cold water coming off Greenland. And that's also contributing to this cold water pool. Now, you can relate this cold water pool. It correlates very strongly with the blob over on the Pacific side. As the El Nino was ramping up in intensity, it was intensifying the blob in the North Pacific and also the secondary blob further south, as well as the El Nino equatorial water temperature. And as the Pacific blob was increasing in temperature, the south of Greenland, the water was cooling even more in that region. So I was talking about the ocean circulation in my last furnace videos, and I talked about Hansen's paper. I did a series of 9 videos dissecting Hansen's paper in the week that it was released. You know, I went into great detail on these so-called superstorms that he is attributing to very large, like, so this cold water blob south of Greenland and the very warm water south, it sets up a large temperature gradient over a short distance. So that creates a sharp pressure gradient over a short distance, and a sharp pressure gradient generates winds. And the sharper the gradient, the stronger the wind. So massive winds. And now we can see what happened. If you'll recall, the jet stream crossing the Atlantic reached record speeds. And so aircraft that were flying from North America to Europe set speed records. I mean, they had ground speeds, which is the speed relative to the ground, of, I think it was 700 kilometers an hour plus, almost 750 kilometers an hour. Like their airspeed of 500 kilometers an hour added to 250 to close to 300 kilometer an hour jet stream winds, which were, you know, we hadn't seen that type of wind speed before. So this is all related to those temperature differences and the cool spot and so on. And UK, just in the last few days, the UK has been hit by hail. It's been hit by lots of storms. I think in the last month or so, they've had lots of storms, lots of enormous waves and so on that are more they're more common in the shoulder season in the fall, when there's a struggle between the cooling air masses and the warmth that's built up over the summer. So we're seeing that earlier. So I think we're in for a massive, you know, uptick of extreme weather once again this fall compared to previous years. I mean, you remember all of the snow on the east coast of the U.S. Last winter, actually it was last fall, really, and the reason that was occurring is because the water off the coast was extremely warm, and when the wind patterns carried over that warm water, they'd pick up all the moisture from the evaporation and carry it over the continent, over the U.S. East Coast, and of course, as it was cooling because of the seasonal change, so we had massive snow dumps. And what strikes me is, and I remember once, so I think we're going to see, you know, it's like batting the hatches. I mean, these storms. Now, I mean, the superstorms that Hansen's talking about are things that we haven't experienced in the Holocene. Those are where you get enormous waves. And, I mean, his view is that it's not tsunami-caused waves. It's just long-period waves of roughly, you know, up to 30 meters in height.
Oh, and, my.
And with a sea level rise in the Eemian, sea level being 9 meters ahead of, you know, 9 meters higher than we are today, plus the 30-meter waves from these long-period massive storms, they move boulders in the Bahamas because the fetch, you know, had a huge fetch. If the winds are from the northeast coming to the southwest, by the time you reach the Bahamas, I mean, you get the waves are the largest. You know, it's like on the lake. I mean, if you're at the downwind side of the lake, that's where the waves are, because the wave height depends on factors. It depends on the speed of the wind, right? The average wind speed. It depends on the fetch, which is the distance over which the ocean, the distance over the water over which the wind is blowing, and it depends also on the duration of the wind. If the wind is strong for a long period of time, then the waves build up over time, of course. So he's attributing these boulders and these chevron geological formations and so on in the Bahamas to basically this type of superstorm with 30-meter waves, persistent waves. And Bermuda, there's also signs that the waves were that big. In fact, there's some forests with 10-meter trees, 10 or 15-meter trees in Bermuda were completely covered by sand in a very short period of time, you know, a season or something, because the trees have fossilized and the records are all there. I mean, the trees were alive and growing, and they were covered, you know, they were completely covered in 15 meters of sand that would be brought up from the seafloor, you know, and with massive wave action, you know, on the north shore of Bermuda. But there is another possible explanation. So this paper, this Hansen paper, of course, was posted online, open, you know, sort of open, accessible to anybody. And it did have peer-reviewed reviewers being picked out, but also many comments, many public comments. And there's a number of comments from John Neeson with the group I'm in, Arctic Methane Emergency Group. And John thinks that, is trying to build the case that perhaps it was very rapid when Greenland was warming very rapidly, and there was massive calving of enormous chunks of ice from southwest Greenland, for example. Then when these entered the water quickly, they could generate tsunamis. And these tsunamis would travel in across the ocean, some of them being reflected off the Mid-Atlantic Ridge sort of thing, and then coming down to the Bahamas. And perhaps it was a series of tsunamis that caused that. Those boulders to be moved 40 meters above present-day sea level rise. It's, you know, I'm not sure. I mean, I think I haven't made a final decision on whether I lean more towards the Hansen superstorm idea or the tsunamis. And I think I have to go with the Hansen one. But John Neeson, he does have some convincing ideas that say that his idea might be the one. The reason. So he's written some things, comments that are publicly accessible. Anybody can go and read Hansen's paper and then the comments, and it's actually quite interesting to do so.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. We're going to live in some interesting times. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and I'm talking with climate scientist Paul Beckwith. He's from the University of Ottawa in Canada. Paul, we've just been through a period of record-setting wildfires in the West, and I've covered a lot of that already. Some listeners may say too much. But my question for you is, do wildfires contribute to global warming through the release of the carbon that was held in the trees and maybe blackening of Arctic from the ash? Or does their smoke cool the earth and the newer growth will reclaim more carbon anyway? Do we know where that balance falls?
I think, you know, you really have to always think of the time scale. So in the extreme short term, while the fires are burning, they're putting up a lot of ash, and typically dust particles in the atmosphere will wash out within about a week or so. And this is why, you know, if we stopped all coal-burning plants and oil, you know, power plant, oil burning for power plants, then the air would become a lot cleaner. And this we'd get a large temperature jump because of the global dimming phenomena that happens from all this particulate matter. So with the fires occurring, they can cause, you know, and of course the ash is moving long distances being carried by the air circulation, and over regions where there's very, you know, lots of ash, lots of smoke, that can cause a darkening, you know, that's through less sunlight, and can cause a cooling, but then the ash is washed out of the air quickly. As long as many fires are burning, then the ash is being continuously generated, right? So it can cause a short-term effect, but the net result is that you're converting the carbon, you know, from the vegetation to carbon dioxide through the combustion process, and that carbon dioxide is going up into the air. So you're giving the atmosphere extra pulses of carbon dioxide. So on the longer term time, you know, beyond the short time scale, you'll get, you definitely, it contributes to the global warming. It contributes to increasing the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere.
Okay, now, a lot of media coverage has been on the droughts, especially in the U.S. Southwest and California, and we've just talked about drying out in the Middle East. The thing is, Paul, we know a warmer atmosphere holds more, not less, water vapor. Will it come down only in extreme rainfall events, or will some parts of the world just get wetter and wetter?
Definitely what we're seeing is, you know, we're seeing this idea that, you know, wetter areas get wetter and drier areas get drier. So we're definitely seeing that sort of thing occurring. So the jet stream, the nature of the jet streams is changing, right? They're slowing, they're becoming wavier, they're more persistent. And so the storms that are carrying more water, 7% more water per degree Celsius, are depositing more, like it's taking them longer to traverse an area. So that area will have the torrential rain event, and that water that would have got elsewhere is not going elsewhere, so the drought areas are getting drier. I mean, one of the things to look at is, you know, tree mortality around the world. There was just a study just within the last few days where they estimated the number of trees on the planet, and they did it. They think they are a lot more accurate than a previous study from, I don't know, about 6 years ago or something. And I think the number they came up with was something like, I think it was like 3 trillion trees or something. Mm-hmm. But what they do say is, and that was a lot more than the study in 2009. Those trees didn't appear. It's just that the accuracy, you know, of their counting using satellites and, you know, better data is, I mean, there's less trees now than there was in 2009. It's just the number is higher because they're counting more accurately. But the key thing is they figure that that's about half of what we had from 100 years ago or a few hundred years ago. Right? We've reduced the tree biomass on our planet by about that amount.
Wow. All right. So moving on now, the Paris climate talks, are they a waste of time and carbon or what?
No. I mean, they're vital, but, you know, should we have high hopes that something will come out of it? You know, I mean, this is going to be COP21, right? So we've had 20 COPs with squat coming out of it, basically, right? I mean, we're not regulating emissions after 20 COPs, so why should the 21st one be successful? But the climate change is much more in the public space now. It's affecting many, many more people than it did before. There's starting to be more recognition, I think, with the public. So I think, you know, once this machinery of society starts to move, you know, to address climate change, like by slashing emissions, I think it can happen. And I think the speed that it will happen over will actually surprise a lot of people. You know, it'll be like turning on a dime sort of thing, is one expression.
Will you go to Paris, Paul?
I'm hoping to go to Paris, yes. I'm hoping to get accreditation, maybe with, you know, Ghana, like I did. I went to Lima, as you know, and had a lot of presentations and things, and I'm working to, it's not definite, but I'm hoping to go to Paris. And, you know, I would add, I mean, there's starting to become pressure from lots of different groups. I mean, the divestment activities on fossil fuels are building. Coal, you know, another large coal company went bankrupt. There's lots of places are divesting from coal specifically, you know, although they're not willing to divest from fossil fuels completely. Of course, the Pope had, you know, his massive encyclical on, you know, and there's, what, 1.2, 1.4 billion Catholics. And the Muslim community had their own, the Islam, they had their own climate change conference and had very strong wording that we need to slash emissions. And, you know, the groundswell is building. I don't know if, I mean, I spent 24 minutes watching the entire Obama speech from the Glacier Conference, it's called Glacier Conference in Alaska. and I think it's useful to listen to rather than, you know, most people will hear a few of the clips that he said, but I think it's worth listening to the full speech. And, you know, he kept repeating how important it was. Like, he seems to really start to get it. I mean, he's mentioned methane. He mentioned, you know, he kept mentioning the huge threat it is to society, and it's happening now. It's not something in the future. And, you know, I haven't heard him talk so strongly on climate change as he did on Monday of this week at the Glacier Conference.
I'm hopeful about that, even though he did just approve some Arctic drilling by Shell, which is kind of contradictory. But yes, Obama has come out with some stronger statements. And I have an inside channel into China saying that they are going to be pretty progressive in these upcoming talks. So there's some hope there. You know, another minor thing that bugs me, Paul, is why do they hold these talks in winter? I mean, Europe may get a string of cold winters, and it just helps the deniers diffuse the situation. I think they should be held in a heat wave during the summer, and maybe the air conditioners in the conference rooms should be turned off. That'd be more realistic and maybe add some pressure for real action, not, you know, 50 or 100 years from now.
Yeah. No, I mean, that it's funny how sometimes, you know, things like that can make a big impact on the result, right? of talks or, yeah, I mean, have the power fail, you know, have it in, you know, the Middle East in the middle of the summer. You know, let's see how many, you know, we'll have delegates keeling over from, you know, 30, 35 degree, 40, well, the temperature, you know, the heat index temperatures, you know.
Well, you know, that was part of the problem of Copenhagen in 2009. It was very, very cold in Denmark that winter, and you had people out there shivering in their big coats saying, we have to fight global warming. And, of course, that just led Senator Inhofe and the other deniers in the U.S. Senate to say, well, look, it's so cold. What are you doing talking about warming?
Yeah, I mean, it's that's you should suggest that to them, that they move to the summer where we know there's going to be a heat wave.
I'm sure they'll listen to me for sure. Look, I have an interview with a British scientist named Chris Bolton coming up, and I plan to ask him about the general idea that the climate may seem to stabilize right before it shifts into a new state. And I think this is partly what you're studying. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, if you look at sort of abrupt change theory, where you go along in one state and then you have a very rapid shift into another state or another regime, or, you know, you might have heard of the word bifurcation, where you have two different states and you can shift between one and the other, and perhaps there's hysteresis, so you can't shift back once you go. And one of the things, if you look at the frequency of changes, if you look at how quickly things change, or, you know, the noise fluctuations of the system, then often there can be a slowing down of the fluctuations, and just before the system will shift. So there's been some studies of looking at some climate shifts to see whether there was any evidence of this slowing down of the system of the sluggishness. But in some cases the slowing down was seen, but in other cases it wasn't. So I mean, people of course are very, you know, very interested. If there was a way we could look at the, you know, if we could predict a rapid shift before it happened. But there's other systems where the fluctuations actually increase in amplitude, and then the whole system shifts. So, you know, it's not, you know, I think it's an active area and it's not something that's new. I mean, people have, you know, electrical engineers have studied this when they're looking at how, you know, say a voltage can suddenly, you know, switch from a low to a high state, and, you know, what happens to the signals in between and so on. Or, you know, physicists, if you're looking at simple harmonic motion systems, or if you're looking at the vibrations of narrow resonance, if you like the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, for example, you know, a slow forcing, which was a very, you know, mild breeze, but over a long period of time, it started setting up vibrations in this bridge. and it was tuned to a resonance frequency of the bridge, and the bridge started vibrating and eventually broke itself apart in this gentle breeze. And in that type of system, you know, you can have a slowing down of the vibrations, because as the fluctuations of the motion of the bridge gets more and more extreme, it's bending metal, it's causing stresses in the metal, the metal's not as resilient. Like, you know, an airplane wing, you look out and, you know, if it's turbulent, you see the wing moving up and down. That's a good thing, right? If the wing wasn't moving at all, then that's a bad thing, right? Because it's moving and it's flexible and it can, you know, stay within limits. So, so systems have a sort of a range over which there's stability. And then if you go outside of that range, you know, that's when you run into abrupt changes, you know, like bend a stick, you know, a little bit and then take the pressure off. It returns to the way it was, bend it a bit more. You know, you can start deforming some of the molecules in the wood and then it doesn't completely recover to where it is if you take the force off and then, you know, apply a bit more force and the thing just snaps. You get this abrupt change. Or, you know, think of, you know, in a canoe, okay? Like you're in a canoe, you lean it over and then center your weight and it corrects. And you can keep doing this and then you reach this sudden point, which is the point of no return in the case of the canoe, and you tip over. So, but some changes are not like that. Some changes are abrupt and there's no sign whatsoever. You know, for example, an episodic stress, like, you know, a meteor impact, for example. I mean, the system, there's no sign in the system that the meteor is going to hit and change everything, right? There's no possible thing you could monitor on the Earth and anticipate that the meteor is going to hit, right?
Well, I almost think of you go to work every morning in a car, and then one morning you go to work and you're in a very serious accident. There may have been nothing in that particular morning to indicate that was going to happen. So if that's the situation, is there any point trying to study whether there are signals that could indicate we're going to hit a climate shift?
Well, it is still worthwhile to, you know, do those studies and find out as much as we can about the different elements of the system and how they interact and how they are changing. I mean, I've been saying for years that I think, you know, our climate, I think we're well into an abrupt climate change situation. I've been saying that for years, but I mean, to prove it scientifically, we just don't really have, like, I don't think anybody can say that. Usually you look in the rearview mirror and you see, oh yeah, well, we did shift, right? That sort of thing. But I mean, relationships are like that. I mean, friends tell me that, you know, they thought their marriage or whatever was going just great, and then suddenly they're out on the street sort of thing, right? And it's like, whoa, this, I never saw this coming, total surprise. And then, you know, after the fact, they maybe see signs that they didn't pick up on and so on, right? So, like, one of the things with abrupt changes is they're always surprising to us.
Right. Surprises. Now, look, I know it's a bit problematic to ask a scientist like yourself, Paul Beckwith, to speculate on how the future will develop. But personally, what could you imagine a sudden climate shift would look like to us?
Well, to get a long, detailed answer on that, you'll have to wait for my book to come out. If it does, if I can focus enough and get something written, because I want to, you know, have a non-technical, you know, discussion of basically what's happened in the past, what's happening now, and where I think we're heading. And I'll make it very clear, you know, what I'm speculating on versus what is well-known science. I mean, I generally, you know, I've talked about this in terms of the Arctic sea ice. So if we lose all of the Arctic sea ice, say, you know, before the end of this decade, so within the next 5 years. I mean, this year is setting up maybe the next year or two to be very interesting, very risky for survival of the sea ice. So, but, you know, let's be on the conservative side. Let's say, you know, 2020 is the first year of no sea ice in the Arctic, so. And that would be for about a month or so, and then the extreme weather events, the jet streams go crazier, slower, chaotic. We get more and more weather extremes occurring. We get possible crop failures globally and turmoil within a year or two after the sea ice is gone for the, you know, maybe up to a month. So the month of September, the first year, or a couple weeks, and within a few years, because the ice isn't cooling the region, and there's a lot more absorption of heat in the dark water, you know, ocean temperatures go up, perhaps the methane release causes another feedback, then we have no sea ice for, you know, maybe 3 months of the year, so maybe August, September, October, you know, in a few more years, you know, 5 months or 6 months of the year are free of sea ice. The Arctic continues to warm. You know, Greenland melt is exponentially rising, even at a faster rate than before. And then within about a decade of the first blue ocean event, no sea ice event, then we have a warm Arctic year-round. And it stays warm throughout the winter season. We don't get ice reforming because the water temperature is extremely warm, you know, throughout the entire Arctic Ocean. And as a result, there's more evaporation. So there's more low-level marine clouds. So these marine clouds basically trap the heat. So the heat doesn't radiate out to space at nighttime. It's trapped. So we have a period, we basically have a different climate, completely, you know, different system. And there's lots of questions are, you know, is there any jet stream at all? I think there could be a very weak jet stream because of the, there'll always be a humidity gradient. The equator is always going to be more humid. The Arctic will be drier. It'll be humid, but not as, of course, not like the equator. And then that humidity gradient could set up a weak jet stream. You know, what happens with the Antarctica ice? What happens with, you know, like there's all these other different interactions. And so, yeah, I mean, this is something I've been struggling to come up with a decent scenario. And, you know, it's subject to change, you know, quite a bit with me, but it's starting to consolidate on a number of different features. You know, it's the details that are changing, not the overall gist of things. So I thought, you know, I'm reaching the point where I think I just need to sit down, lock myself in a room for a couple of weeks and just write a book.
I'd like to read it. I'd like to read it for sure. I think we're going to have to wrap up there. Listeners, you can follow our guest Paul Beckwith on Facebook and through his up-to-date and always informative YouTube videos. Beckwith is B-E-C-K-W-I-T-H. Just Google that. And you can find links to all of that in my Radio EcoShock blog. I publish it every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Paul, thank you so much for joining us again on Radio EcoShock. I know we could have talked for another hour on the upcoming changes to the world, but as you say, we'll look forward to it in your book.
Well, I guess I've committed myself to a book.
You're committed now. Just in your spare time, Paul, aside from working on your thesis and your videos and all the other things you do, thanks so much.
Yeah, well, thanks again. And I got hit by climate change a week ago.
What happened?
I got some poison ivy. And it's horrible. I think the poison ivy is strengthening. The potency of the sap is strengthening under climate change. There's also the hogweed and there's wild parsnip. Those are things that people should look at and make sure they recognize what they are, because they're just as bad as poison ivy these days.
The plants will change, the bugs will change. We're not alone. Thanks again, Paul Beckwith.
Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock. News they just don't tell you. In climate news they don't tell you, Paul Beckwith talked about the heat wave that hit Japan this past August. It was hardly reported in the West, but here's a short clip from Vice News August 6th.
A heat wave has killed at least 40 people in Tokyo. Temperatures soared above 95 degrees Fahrenheit for 6 days in a row. More than 11,000 people have been hospitalized. Japan's aging population is particularly vulnerable to the heat. Nearly half of those treated were over the age of 65.
But there's a huge story lost in the mix of Western celebrity news, the refugee crisis, and the developing stock market crash. It's this. Eastern Europe has been baking under a heat dome for over a month. Here's a clip from Ukraine Today on August 11th explaining how carbon-polluting coal plants can be shut down due to their own climate-wrecking impacts, this time in Poland.
Europe's heat wave has forced Poland to sharply cut electricity supplies to industry for the first time in over a decade, pushing some companies to limit production. Prime Minister Ewa Kopacz called the situation very serious, as weather forecasts for the coming days showed high temperatures are to persist. The local unit of the world's largest steelmaker, ArcelorMittal, halted some of its operations, describing the situation as very difficult. The heat wave and lack of rain cut the amount of water needed to cool coal-fired power plants, from which Poland generates about 90% of its electricity. The country has virtually no solar energy generating capacity. Temperatures in Poland topped 30 degrees Celsius last week and may reach 39 degrees this week, according to Poland's Meteorology Institute. In Romania, ships faced slow progress along the Danube River after days of hot weather left water levels low. Navigation was particularly difficult, especially at Zimnitsia, 125 kilometers southeast from the capital Bucharest.
The heat in Ukraine itself just keeps on coming. On September 3rd, the capital Kiev ordered a shutdown of the school system due to continuing extreme heat plus smoke from peat bog fires. Burning peat was the source of the pollution that helped kill over 10,000 people in Russia in 2010, including many in the capital Moscow. Once set ablaze, peat can burn for months, perhaps into the winter, and releases a lot of extra carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. Peat fires in Indonesia covered much of Southeast Asia in the winter of 1997-98 and made Indonesia the world's third largest source of carbon dioxide that year. Peat fires are also sending up smoke in western Russia, easily seen by satellite. Check out Robert Scribler's blog, dated September 3rd, titled "Smoke from Peat Bog Fires Blankets Europe and Russia Amidst Record Heat and Drought." According to the Associated Press, September 3rd, quote, "Kiev broke an all-time record for September 1st when the temperatures reached 35.5 degrees Celsius, 95.9 Fahrenheit. Rainfall in August was just 4% of the average, according to the local weather forecasters. Health Ministry spokesman Svyatoslav Protas said air pollution in the Ukrainian capital on Thursday was twice to 18 times higher than normal levels, depending on the neighborhood. My thanks to listeners who sent in these tips of news they just don't tell you. During my summer break, I worried what to make of the upcoming climate conference in Paris. My starting contribution is a new song called "In the Streets of Paris." If you like it, download it free from my blog at ecoshock.info or from the Radio EcoShock SoundCloud page. You can also share this tune through social media using the SoundCloud links or embed the music in your own blog or website. I hope you will. Please tweet your brains out about this. We're going to need all the help we can get to pressure world leaders to get real in Paris to save the climate and our descendants from horrible heating, extreme weather, rising seas, and massive extinction. Thank you for listening again this week. I've got lots of great guests coming up for you in the next few weeks. Here is "In the Streets of Paris."
Heat is building, records falling, revolution time has come. Suits and limousines, all important people meet in locked up rooms. From outside our voices calling save the climate. From the streets of Paris, oh yeah. Say you don't need to fly there. Every street we meet on is Paris where we live. Late this November, late in climate time, we all meet in our streets of Paris. Oh, yeah.
In the streets of Paris.
They deal to corporations, pulled by billionaires. They need to hear the people. Now and in the future, we demand the action. Get off that carbon train in the streets of Paris. Humans grow in numbers, economies in size, an atmosphere of poisons flies into the skies. Meet me in November, green me in December, hold their feet to the climate fire. Let us all remember, fate hangs in the balance. In the streets of Paris, in the streets of Paris, in the streets of Paris, in the streets of Paris. Driving on is easy, oil slaves are great. Doing nothing is the mantra in the sinking ships of state. Fall into a stupor, we all fall into a shock. We're burning golden energy and no one wants to stop. My grandchild looks in innocence. What's in our will? Storms, floods and fire, society is ill. Leaders in your finery, remember the Bastille. Listen to the shouts now, if only you will. In the streets, in the streets.
In the streets of Paris.
Friends, you know the score. Wherever this may find you, promise to take action and show them what you mean. Pull together now in the winter of 15. Make your main street crowded. Stand up where you are. The bell of time is ringing. The bell of time is ringing in the streets of Paris.